Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm happy to say we have David Schimmelpennig van der Ooy on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Russian Orientalism, Asia in the Russian Mind, from Peter the Great to the Emigration. Of course, there was a time in Russian history before European contact in which the Russians were thinking neither about Europe nor about Asia. They thought of the people that lived to the east of them and to the south of them, most of whom were Turkic-speaking, as simply the Turkic-speaking people who lived to the east of them and the south of them. However, after the Russians were convinced that they were Europeans, and this happened roughly in the 18th century, they began to think of the East differently as the Orient. This is really the story that David tells in this wonderful book. It's related, of course, to the greater issue of Orientalism and its meaning. Many of the listeners to this show will be acquainted with Orientalism, the book by Edward Said. David engages that book and has some very interesting things to say about the applicability of the notion of Orientalism in the Russian space. And he also has some other interesting things to say about the origins of Said's own thought in Russian thought. So I would advise you to listen carefully to a point near the end of the interview in which he lays bare the roots of Said's notion. In any event, I really enjoyed talking to David today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, David.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fabulous. It's Friday afternoon. What could be better?
Yeah, no, it's really great. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to David Schimmelpennig van der Ooy today, and David is in Paris. Is that right, David?
That's right.
Yeah. I feel really sorry for you. That's horrible. David has written a terrific book called Russian Orientalism, Asia in the Russian Mind, from Peter the Great to the Emigration. I've just finished the book, and it's absolutely terrific. It touches on a subject that I've thought about a lot myself, because some of my very early work was on European views of Russians. This is a book about Russian views of people in the, well, I hesitate here because they're in the south and in the east, and it's a little bit different in Russia. But in any event, it's a terrific book, and I encourage people to go out and buy it. David, why don't I ask you to begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I guess the main thing to say is that I came to history in a rather roundabout way. I have a very checkered past, which includes 10 years as an investment banker in Toronto and the City of London, a commission in the Canadian Armor Corps, and work as a waiter in a fancy French restaurant in Chicago. But my major actually was Russian studies, but back in those days, and this was in the 70s when I was an undergraduate, I thought I'd become a diplomat. And then I learned through my military service that bureaucrats are intrinsically evil people, and I didn't want to be like them. So by a roundabout way, I ended up in banking, but I realized that I really did not like banking at all. And I found myself around the late 80s in London, in the city, doing stuff that I found tremendously mind-numbingly boring, doing things like looking at the bakery sector in Belgium or the insurance industry in the Netherlands and things like that. The pay was fabulous. I'll never again make as much money as I did as a peach-faced 30-year-old in London. But I got increasingly bored, and I discovered that the only time I was pretty happy during the day was after work. After, of course, these long, notorious 12-hour work days in banking, and I would be in a pub. This was when pubs still closed early, so I had 1 hour to have my dinner, have my pint, and have my cigar. And I began to think about, well, what makes me happy in life? And anyway, I said what I really enjoyed doing was reading. And it wasn't so much reading the Financial Times or Euro Money magazine. It was much more reading, say, a biography of Stolypin or a book about Silver Age poetry. And I thought, well, maybe I should get paid to do this. So to make a long story short, I applied to graduate school, and Yale very kindly accepted me, despite my very advanced age of 31. All my relatives in Europe said that by the age of 30, you know, I was really well set on a career, and I should just buck up, and, you know, it's only 30 more years till retirement. And so I went to graduate school, and I was very lucky to end up at a place like Yale, because Yale, as you may know, well, at the time, was not necessarily one of the top places to do Russian history, which had its advantages, because there are very few graduate students there. It has a very good history department. But that forces you sort of to look outside of the realm of just Russian studies. And as luck would have it, I had an advisor with very Catholic interests, Paul Bushkovich, although at the time he was really classified as a medievalist. He knew a lot about 19th century history, which was my forte. And I was also very fortunate to work with Jonathan Spence. Indeed, my minor field was in Chinese history. So that's how I really happened on my dissertation topic, which was really, well, like all dissertations, very, very sort of specific and narrow. It looked at how Russians thought about Asia just before the Russo-Japanese War, period from 1895 to 1904. Now, one of my other professors at that time was a diplomatic historian, Paul Kennedy. And at that point, he had a lot of graduate students, and more to the point, he had a lot of money to send them abroad. So thanks to Paul Kennedy's largesse, I was able to spend as much time as I wanted to in Russia. And I happened to happen there in 1993, which is just shortly after the various archives were opening. So I was able to write sort of a diplomatic slash intellectual history of the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War. That ended well. I mean, eventually, after long tribulations, it was published. And meanwhile, I was very lucky to get a job in Canada. You never know where you're going to get a job, and it's often a very long and agonizing process. But I was very lucky to get a job in Brock University, just a small provincial university close to Niagara Falls. By Canadian standards, it's actually in the tropics because it's in the wine growing district, and a very pleasant place to be. They let me basically do what I want to do, which is completely unfashionable stuff like diplomatic, military history, with touches of intellectual history. And they also let me go off to France on sabbatical. So I can't complain. So here I am, 12 years into Brock, recently having survived 3 years agony as department chair, but now enjoying my just reward on sabbatical.
That's an absolutely terrific story. There are not many Russian historians who have that sort of background. I would go as far as to say there aren't any Russian historians who have that kind of background. So,
which is probably a good thing.
Well, I don't know. I was thinking about it. That's bringing that kind of experience. I know that I worked in what we sometimes call here in America the real world for a time, and in my teaching I find it very valuable because I know what employers expect. And
it's also very useful as a professor to have links with the real world.
Yeah, no, that's right.
I mean, you do realize, first of all, you do realize how incredibly blessed you are to be an academic.
Oh, yeah.
And that would go a long way towards making some of my colleagues a little less grumpy about, say, you know, having to attend committees occasionally or occasionally being forced to teach something slightly outside of their field. So I think it's very good for people to, in fact, I think every graduate school should make it obligatory for graduate students to spend at least 5 years doing something completely, completely different. I think our field would be much better off for it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm absolutely certain of that. So from your lips to God's ears, I want to ask you, since you were in an armored corps, is that right?
That's right.
See, I want to talk about tanks, but I'm not going to do that because I love tanks. We can talk about that after the interview, but let's talk about how you came to write this book, Russian Orientalism. How did you come to write it?
Well, completely serendipitously. I was going through that agonizing ritual of supplicating academic presses to take on this very unfashionable diplomatic history of the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War. And I took it to Yale University Press. I happened to be at Yale at the time, and I knew the editor, Jonathan Brent. He looked at it, and I called him up. I didn't hear from him, so I called him up, and the first words he said on the phone were, "Well, David, this is very interesting." So I knew then right away that, before he even went on, that they weren't going to take it. But he did say, "Come and see me, and you know, we'll make it publishable." And he said, "Well, David, the first thing you better do is take off all the footnotes." Well, damn it, I sweated over every one of those bloody footnotes, so I wasn't about to do that. Eventually, it was taken by another press, but meanwhile, I happened to run into Jonathan at a AAASS, well, the American Association for Slavic Studies conference. And he said, David, what about your book? And I said, well, you know, I really can't sort of remove all the footnotes and make it into a much more popular book. And then he looked at me and said, look, why don't you publish a book that I really want you to publish, which is how Russians more generally have thought about Asia. And so, lo and behold, even before I had a contract for my thesis, I had a contract for this book. That was back in 1990. Back in 2000. And in the intervening years, well, I had a few children and of course, had to teach, but managed to get the book written about 8 years later.
Yeah. But at that time, you weren't working in the restaurant or serving in an armored division or being a...
No. At that point,
good. Yeah. You're a person of many talents, but it's incredible. So let's actually talk about the book in itself. You begin by talking about the kind of long-term relationship, that is this sort of in the earliest period relationship between the Russians and, again, it's hard to name these people because from the Russian point of view, they aren't Asian or Oriental or anything like that in the early modern period. They're something else. But why don't you just talk a little bit about, Kievan Rus and Muscovite Russia and their relationship to parts Eastern.
Yes, and of course, I have to preface this because I come from a country that has a very large Ukrainian community. So, of course, I have to preface this by saying that these are people that would eventually become partially Russian, partially Ukrainian, and whatever. But to make matters simple, I'll speak of them as the Rus. These were a fairly sedentary people, very closely linked to the rest of Europe, in fact, European, who at the time, and by the time I mean the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, inhabited the forests right on the edge of the great inner Asian steppe. And as a result, they were in daily contact or in regular contact with various Turkic sort of nomadic horsemen who inhabited the steppe. And as the Rus eventually became Christianized and developed a literature, a great deal of literature was about this almost daily interaction with these people of the steppe. Sometimes hostile, very often not hostile. Of course, violence, well, as anybody who reads the newspaper knows, violence makes the headlines much more readily than specific events. And so what the chronicles that were kept by these medieval monks, these early Christian monks in monasteries of Kievan Rus, spoke a lot was about wars or about violent encounters. But these people also, the Kievan Rus also intermarried and traded with these people of the steppe. And so over the centuries, they developed a relationship that was both symbiotic, but also occasionally hostile. Until, of course, by about this, and I should preface this by saying that this interaction was relatively stable. Occasionally, the people of the forest, the Slavs, who were basically tillers of the land and looked for products of the forest, interacted with these nomads. Their battles occasionally ended in a draw, occasionally victory for one or the other, but it was a relatively balanced relationship until suddenly a very violent new people surged in from inner Asia. And these, of course, were the descendants of Genghis Khan's Mongols, who in 3 or 4 short years overran virtually all of what is now Russia and Ukraine, and in fact nearly got to the gates of Vienna until they turned back. So for about 2.5 centuries, the descendants of these Kievan Rus were under the sway of what they call the Mongol yoke, the Tsarskaya Iga, and only really cast off that yoke or became independent sometime in the 14th or 15th century, depending on how you define independence. They finally renounced Mongol rule around 1480. So what you have is a people that initially came into contact and had intimate contact with various people from inner Asia, people who were racially distinct, perhaps, but intermarried with them. And some people would argue that this had a strong influence. Others would argue that's not so, but that's another debate. But eventually were conquered by people from Inner Asia and then threw off that yoke and then slowly entered modernity and became the Russia that we all know and love.
Mm-hmm. So how did this is where you brought us roughly to the 16th century, and this is the era of many of our listeners will know Ivan the Terrible, but also sort of the beginnings of Europeanization. Prior to the 16th century, the Russians had not had contact with, I guess I would call it, Mitteleuropa. You know, these are the German lands, and then parts further
yes.
west. How did this impact the way in which the Muscovites, come Russians, thought about these steppe peoples?
Well, this is a very interesting point. Is that the Russians really saw themselves as in between Europe and Asia, as really not part of either. In fact, there's an old saying that much woe has been brought to us both by the Turk and by the German Catholic, or by the Roman Pope. So Russians really didn't really think of Asians the same way that Europeans did. Of course, they thought they developed an increasingly hostile view of Islamic, and most of their Asian neighbors at that point were Islamic, because the church told them to. But they really didn't think of Asians in the same way that Europeans did. Muscovites were, as you well know, well, this is a lot of your work, were intensely insular people who saw themselves as besieged by unbelievers, both from the Islamic East and South, as well as from the Catholic West. And I really don't get a sense that they considered one to be more evil or less hostile than the other. It's really only in with Peter's slow import of Western ideas that Russians really begin to distinguish between themselves as part of Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an extraordinarily subtle and really quite excellent characterization of the Muscovite mind, because they did feel that they were besieged on all sides, and then they also felt that they were superior to almost everybody else. This is perhaps a consequence of their own insularity. But anyway, let's talk about Peter. What is the importation of these really now European ideas into the Russian elite? What impact does it have on Russian views of the steppe peoples?
Well, Russians now begin to identify much more closely with Europeans, and in part because Peter also imports sort of the Western way of looking at the world academically and culturally. And by the same token, imports the Western view of looking at Asia. Now, what's very interesting is that Russia becomes Westernized, for want of a better term, during the 18th century, late 17th, but really the 18th century. And this is precisely a time, I think at no time before or afterwards, has the West looked more positively on Asia. Remember, this is the age of Voltairean Sinophilia and of Chinoiserie, of a fascination with the East. During the Enlightenment, people in the West became increasingly skeptical or even dismissive of the Catholic Church and of Western Christianity in general. And they looked to other sources of spirituality, including Islam and even Confucianism, perhaps as other models that might be equally valid. It was an intensely cosmopolitan age. So it was precisely at this time that Russia began to look at the East that through Western eyes, that the West looked at the East through very positive eyes. So indeed, for much of the 18th century, although Russians, of course, fought many wars with the Turks, there were clashes, never quite came to war, but also had a fairly difficult relationship with the Qing Empire. But nevertheless, culturally, Russians looked on the East as something fairly positive, and praised wet Chinese learning. And even Islamic learning for providing fonts of wisdom that were perhaps absent in the tired West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that bears adding, and you, of course, mentioned it in the book, is that we shouldn't just speak of the assimilation of these European ideas by Russians, that in many cases these were actually Europeans, people like Catherine. She was a German. So it's they brought these ideas with them, if you see what I mean.
Well, not only was Catherine or Sophie of Anhalt Zerbst German, but a lot of the most of the members of the Academy of Sciences that Peter had established, shortly after his death. But most of its first members were German. The languages used were German and Latin. And in fact, one of the things that fascinated me was that when universities were first established in Russia, the language of instruction very often tended to be Latin. Mm-hmm. Now you can imagine some poor kid from from Moscow going to university and everything is in Latin. And their professors, well, the only other languages they spoke were German, perhaps French.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So one of the narrative threads in the book is, in fact, the institutional development of Orientology in Russia. And this is related to a kind of broader theme that is captured in the title of the book, and maybe we should spend a few minutes talking about it. And this is the idea of Orientalism. Could you talk a little bit about its ancestry and meaning to, I guess, academic culture? What is Orientalism, and who thought it up?
Well, I'm not quite sure when exactly the term came into existence, but Orientalism in the 19th century was a fairly neutral term, which meant two things. Artistically, it meant a very specific art school that was fascinated by the light and the exoticism of primarily the Near East. It flourished in the middle of the 19th century. It's basically an outgrowth of Romanticism. But more important, Orientalism or Orientology was the study of the East, often the Near East, but often the East in general. And in the 19th century, it was tended to be the preserve of very erudite, generally fairly eccentric men who studied terribly difficult languages, many of them dead, like Sanskrit, or say Mongolian, Mandarin, and the like. They tend to be very reclusive men who read manuscripts and woodblock books and the like. And they were... Well, basically, every university worth its salt by the turn of the 20th century, of course, had to have a few Orientologists. But it was really a fairly neutral term. And unless you were terribly bright or you intended to go into government service or become a missionary, you really paid very little attention to these people. They were a necessary part of any great research university's faculty. And this was all fine and good until the 1970s, when a Palestinian, a Christian Palestinian, who was then professor of comparative literature at New York at Columbia University, wrote a fairly polemic book called Orientalism. This, of course, is the late Edward Said. Now, his ideas weren't terribly original, but he put them in a way in a way that was really convincing, and argued that, well, people who study the East from the West do so basically to conquer and to oppress the East. And so by the late 70s and the early 80s, the term Orientalism or Orientology or even the word Orient came to have a very, very pejorative definition or rather air to it. And as a result, various departments, which had proudly been called departments of Oriental Letters, were suddenly rechristened Department of Near Eastern Studies or of Asian Studies or what have you. But until fairly recently, the word Orientalism has really been a four-letter word in the academy. I look at it much more neutrally. For one thing, is that I think Said did something very important, exploring the link between knowledge and power. He argues that Orientalism is part of the Western apparatus to basically impose its will on the East. In other words, just at the same time that French, British, German officers were conquering lands offshore and colonies, their linguists, their jurists, and even their historians were part and parcel of the same process of colonialism or of imperialism. Now, there's something very wrong with that argument. Yes, of course, Orientologists very often served a state that was also acquiring colonies abroad in the 19th and even in the 20th century. On the other hand, you don't sacrifice your life studying something terribly difficult because you have an intrinsic dislike of those people, or at least most people don't. I can think of one or two people in our field, which are remain nameless. But I mean, you don't study Russian to become a Russophobe.
That's exactly right. I try to explain that to people as well. You're very diplomatic. Maybe you should have become a diplomat. I don't know. I would have named names, but not that's just me. You know? So I thought that was again a terrific characterization of exactly what Orientalism was, and that is an academic institution, an academic practice by which people studied things that were from the Western perspective in the East, and then of course it becomes politicized by Said and the entire. I don't know, American. I was going to put some adjective before that, but some sort of establishment. I don't know what sort of establishment it was. But
yeah, although it's interesting that there has been, you know, all these things go through fads, and there has been a bit of a reaction to that. I think people are now beginning to realize. Robert Irwin, for example, wrote a wonderful book a couple of years ago. He would probably call himself an Orientalist, but he's basically the Times Literary Supplement editor for Near Eastern books, uh-huh. book reviews. And he, among others, has sort of written a riposte to Said. So I until very recently, that was really a given wisdom. But I think there's a bit of a reaction to that now because people realize that perhaps this view was a bit one-sided.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So, but nonetheless, you chose it for the title of your book. It's in the title of your book. How do you mean it? In the Russian context? What does it mean in the Russian context?
Well, I mean it both in the cultural and the... I deliberately used the term Orientalism because it is a fairly vague term, and I really wanted to encompass both academic and artistic perceptions of the East, because I think there's really no one way that you can characterize the way that Russians looked at the East. And I really didn't want to limit myself to just one source of text, like, say, travel accounts or purely academic works. I really wanted to sort of take a very broad brush approach to how Russians viewed the Orient.
And you succeeded that marvelously.
So I basically mean Orientalism in the traditional sense, studying or looking at the East, at the Orient. The Orient, of course, is, well, that's where the sun rises. So everything that is to the east of us or to the east of Russia. To make things very complicated, of course, you know, what is the East for Russians? Moscow, after all, geographically lies to the east of Istanbul and Jerusalem, even though it is technically in Europe.
Mm-hmm. So we left off our story in the 18th century, and this is kind of at the birth of serious Russian, and I put Russian in air quotes, Russian study of the East, because the original faculty members at Peter's Academy, and then a little bit later, were German. So tell us a little bit about the origins of Eastern studies, so to say, Oriental studies in Russia in the 18th century.
Well, there are basically two currents, which is what makes Russian Orientalism or Orientology, by that I mean the academic study of the East, fairly unique. The very first people to sort of study the East, like Gottlieb, Siegfried, Bayer, and the like, were basically Germans who were imported along with many other German scholars by Peter the Great. And these people tended to be very interested in Russia because they saw in Russia many traces of its Tatar and its Mongol heritage. So these were people who had studied, say, Chinese or Sanskrit or the like, came to Russia because there they could learn through archaeological finds or manuscripts, they could learn more about the East, but really an import from the East. But slightly later, there was a parallel phenomenon of people who either were themselves Eastern in the sense that they came from Russia's Eastern nationalities or who actually came from the East. Who also became scholars. And I'm thinking here of people, and this is really more developed in the 19th century as Russian Orientology really began to develop. it really began to develop in universities, in places like Kazan. Kazan is a city that is about 600 kilometers east of Moscow on the Volga River, but it is really a city that was one of the last Tatar strongholds, and it has a very large Tatar or sort of Islamic Turkic community still very much to this day. And the university there, in right at the beginning of the 19th century, had a very strong faculty of Orientology, which was developed basically to train administrators and others who could deal with Russia's Eastern nationalities and also beyond. It was quite natural to get people, the people who know those languages best were not Russians who'd been trained in the East, but people actually from the East. So many language instructors at Kazan were actually native Tatars or Mongolians, Buryats and the like. And the key figure in the early 19th century for the development of Orientology at Kazan was a man named Mirza Alexander Kasimovich Kazembek. You can tell sort of by this sort of mixed Russianized version that this fellow was really a hybrid. He was born in Iran, or in Persia, as it was called then, and his father had been exiled to Astrakhan. His son, Alexander Kasimovich, converted to Presbyterianism, and eventually was, by a roundabout way, was drafted into Russian service and ended up teaching at Kazan's university. But here was a man whose academic training really had been in the East, in the Islamic world, in Islamic madrasas and the like. A lot of the other early Russian Orientologists also were essentially trained in the East. It was very typical in the 19th century, really until the late 19th century, whereas people who, say, studied engineering, medicine, Western philology or the like would be sent off to, say, Göttingen or Heidelberg or Paris or Oxford. People who were trained as Orientologists at Kazan and then at St. Petersburg in the latter part of the 19th century would be sent off to the East. They would be sent off, say, to Peking, where the Orthodox Church had sort of a mission, or they might be sent off to Constantinople or other places in the Ottoman Empire, basically to learn Arabic, Turkish, Chinese, Mongolian, Tibetan, on the ground, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so these, in addition to learning languages, of course, these people also assimilated Eastern Asian traditions, academic traditions, and were very much patriots of these academic traditions. Many of the Orientologists of the early to mid-19th century really did not have much contact or much interest in Western scholarship of the East because they considered that Western scholars were dilettantes, whereas these people who'd spent 5 to 10 years in the East knew that field much, much better and much more intimately. And also, I should add, also thought much more highly of Eastern learning than they thought of Western learning. So you really have two elements of Russian Orientalism in Orientology in the 19th century, which is the Western academic way of looking at things, and certainly the academic structure. I mean, the whole university structure, as in America, in Russia, was imported from Germany in the 19th century. But its Orientology branch also had a very strong influence of Eastern academic elements. So it is really sort of a hybrid between the East and the West.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So how did the Russian government use the graduates of these programs and the academics who taught in them? What was the purpose of studying the East in this period?
That was a very controversial question. A number of Orientologists and certainly a number of university administrators felt that one should study the East, for raison d'état, to have colonial administrators who could, say, speak Tatar or Buryat or Kalmyk or the like, or to have diplomats who were well-versed in Mandarin or Farsi or Arabic or the like. And so these people were being trained for government service in the East. But there were also people who, although they were funded by by the state, studied it for out of intrinsic interest. But really, the state itself really wanted to have a cadre of trained administrators who knew the East's languages, cultures, laws, and ways. Remember that Russia at the time, and Bob Cruz has a wonderful way of, does this very nicely in his book about the interaction between the Russian state and its Islamic subjects. Remember that the Russian Empire in the 19th century still tended to let its Eastern minorities very often to be ruled according to their own traditions. But it still needed administrators, Russian nationals, who could nevertheless supervise those traditions. Administrators who could, say, advise the governor general of Turkestan or the governor of Western Siberia or the like, really how Sharia works or how Mongol common law works, all the better to administer these subjects. So the state really wanted to train servants.
Mm-hmm. And what about the church? The church also trained a certain number of people to do this. Was there missionary activity that was related to Orientology?
Well, this again is a complicated question because, yes, the church was interested, occasionally was interested in training missionaries. Now, as a caveat, I should stress that the Orthodox Church, at least in Russia, traditionally has a much weaker missionary tradition than the Western Church. There was basically an attitude of live and let live. Certainly in the 19th century, there were the occasional missionaries, but even in Kazan, which established a missionary division, at least at a theological academy in the mid-19th century, even there, most of the emphasis was really on converting so-called old believers, in other words, Orthodox who had strayed, if you will, or had refused to accept reforms much earlier and were sort of seen as heretics, as opposed to, say, trying to convert Muslims or Buddhists. So it was a very weak effort. There were some people who studied Arabic or who studied Tatar or who studied Mongolian, and some people occasionally did go out to places like Irkutsk to try and convert the so-called heathen and so-called pagans. But these people suffered from disinterest and really also dislike. It was slightly a sense. This reminds me a lot of the story that when I was in the army, I was into reconnaissance, and the function of reconnaissance, light armed reconnaissance, is to find the enemy. In the 1970s, of course, that was the evil empire. Well, I happened to be a Russian studies major, and as a result, on my bookshelf in barracks, I had a lot of books on Russian history, mostly biographies of Russian tsars. And I remember one colonel during inspection who took me to task for having these books on Russian history. And he said, "Why do you have these books?" And he picked up one, which was a biography of Nicholas I. And he said, "Why are you reading these books about a Russian king? Are you a communist?" It was the same with people who studied Islam, who studied Arabic or studied Buddhism. The more you studied it, the less you were trusted by your own co-religionists, even if you were a very devout Orthodox monk or priest.
Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, let's move away from the kind of where the rubber meets the road, if you'll pardon the cliche, kinds of Orientology, that is to train administrators or to train missionaries. Oriental themes sort of leach out into Russian culture and Russian letters, Russian style. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yes, very much like Orientology as an academic discipline, this fascination with Oriental styles really came from the West, first with Chinoiserie and Turquerie in the reign of Catherine the Great, and then one of its strongest waves was in the Romantic era, just as Byron in the West popularized Near Eastern themes in literature, and as Fromentin popularized Near Eastern themes in Western painting. This sort of vogue also hit Russians. Now, the big difference between Russians and Westerners was that for Westerners to become acquainted with the East, you had to travel away. You had to go from, say, Paris or London to to the Ottoman Empire or beyond, whereas for Russians, it was much nearer at home. And a lot of, especially in the 1830s, 1840s, as Russia was mired in the Caucasus, a lot of people, intellectual figures, and in part, partially because they were intellectual, sometimes they were exiled to the Caucasus, like Lermontov. People there became fascinated by Oriental themes. Now, these were literate people. They had read the way that Westerners had described the East, and here was the East very much closer to home. But they found it fascinating, fascinating for its very different, somehow more colorful lifestyle, certainly much more interesting, more colorful, freer, and to their eyes, more honest than the very refined ways of St. Petersburg in the early 19th century. Now, what's very interesting about this turn to the East is that Eastern themes in Russian art and Russian literature sort of begin to decline sort of at the end of the so-called Golden Age, really that first fluorescence of Russian literature in the age of Pushkin, 1830s, 1840s. But toward the end of the 19th century, in the so-called Silver Age, sort of a rebirth of Russian letters, Russians, again, after having been very interested in their own issues, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky all write about, you know, mostly about issues closer to home. By the end of the 19th century, so again, a rebirth. With a twist, at this point, Russians are more and more conscious of a very strong Asian element in their own culture. And so you have people like Andrei Bialy, who writes a novel about St. Petersburg, in which the lead character is a bureaucrat, a very westernized bureaucrat, but who has Tatar ancestry. And his culmination, of course, is a very famous poem by Alexander Blok, Scythians, in which he says, you know, yes, we are Scythians and Asians too. Very much a rejection of the West. Russians who celebrate their Asian roots to a certain extent, and also use it as a way to differentiate themselves from the West. Mm-hmm. Certainly people who had a more entrepreneurial bent very much fed on the traditional Western cliché of scratch a Russian and you'll find a Tatar, by capitalizing on it, by sort of celebrating that in the West. And here I'm thinking, of course, of Diaghilev and his Ballet Russe, who in the early 20th century, staged operas and ballets with very exotic themes that really sort of, in Paris, and in the Occident, very much stress Russia's soi-disant Oriental element. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about something our listeners may have heard of, and I'm certainly interested in it because my dissertation advisor wrote one of the early works on it, and that is the thing called Eurasianism. Could you talk a little bit about its origins and its relations to Orientology and Orientalism?
Well, Eurasianism, as you can tell by the word, is a combination of Europe and Asia. And it is a Russian idea that Russia is sort of an intermediate world between the West and the East, a distinctive world that somehow combines both elements of Europe and of Asia, but is also a world apart. It is basically, although the argument is that Russia combines both East and West, it is basically meant as a rejection of the West. It is basically an expression of suspicion and dislike of the West. It has its roots in a much better known intellectual current in mid-19th century Russia that some of your listeners are probably familiar with, Slavophilism, which is basically the idea that Russia, although it is Europe and Christian, is fundamentally different from, say, the Roman and German traditions, but it's part of a more spiritual, a less materialist, a more paternalistic culture of the Byzantine Orthodox East. Now, the big difference between Eurasianism and Slavophilism, both, of course, reject the West, the Romano-Germanic West with its parliaments, its democracy, its private sector, and the like, Eurasianism basically argues that Russia, well, it's not really the links with Byzantine East that we're interested in, but really the links with the with Inner Asia East, with the world of the nomads, with the much more patriarchal order, and that rejects the sterile materialism of the West. Now, this was a very pure movement that was adhered to by a group of very learned exiles in Prague and eventually elsewhere in Europe in the 20s and 30s. A very distinguished linguist, Prince Rubetskoy, musicologist, a geographer, eventually a man named George Vronsky, who ended up his years as a Yale history professor. But he started out arguing basically that the Asian element in Russia was very strong. Now, really, until the 80s, Eurasianism was really a backwater of Russian intellectual history. There was the odd article. If you sort of did a bibliography of Eurasianism, you might find one or two articles in German. There's one in French. There's one in Dutch. But that was about it. And a couple in American, of course, or in English. But suddenly, in the late 1980s, as communism became increasingly discredited in the Soviet Union, and people were losing their intellectual moorings in Russia, some people, there was a revival of Eurasianism in Russia, and some people began to argue, well, yes, you know, perhaps we're not Marxist, but we are still unique and distinct, and it is our Eurasian element that makes us unique and distinct. And very interestingly, Eurasianism now has become a movement of the far right. Now, what do I mean by the far right in Russia? These things are very confusing because the Communist Party of the Russian Federation on the Russian political spectrum really is on the right. And in fact, even the head of the Communist Party now, Gennady Zyuganov, very provenly writes of Eurasianism, with the idea that Russia is essentially has some very strong Asian roots. I want to emphasize, it doesn't mean that Russia sees itself as Asia, but it does have Asian roots, and that sets it apart from the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. This is a little bit beyond the bounds of the pages of your book, but how do Russians today think about Asia or the Orient? How do they talk about it? Where do they put themselves in the Europe, Russia, Asia frame?
Well, and of course, it depends which Russian you're speaking to. If you're speaking to, say, a policeman in Khabarovsk or in Vladivostok, right on the Chinese border, or if you're talking to a soldier in Chechnya, they will think of Asians as Zhelty Lytsi, yellow faces, or Cherny, or blacks. They will think of them in very, very negative terms. But if you speak to intellectuals in the cities, they tend to think of Asia a bit more positively. There is really no single way to characterize the way that Russians think of Asia. It's sort of they're very mixed feelings. I mean, my very good friend Nikos Frisidis, who's a Greek, originally of Pontic origin, and I were in graduate school together in Russia in the 1990s, and typically, the policeman in the subways would very often stop him and ask for his papers. Now, the minute it's Greek, they're best of friends because he's fellow Orthodox. But they thought that he was a Caucasian. So there's a strong element of racism. But on the other hand, there is some sort of sympathy for the East as well. And Russians feel themselves a bit vulnerable vis-a-vis the West. After all, to put it in starkly Reagan-esque terms, they lost the Cold War. And so there's sort of a sense of bitterness to a certain extent, especially among more patriotic Russians, towards the West. And one of the refuges is thinking, well, we are not like the West. We have more in common, say, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Iranians. And there's a certain perverse identification with nations that are very anti-Western. So the more anti-American, or the greater their hostility between, say, Iran and the U.S. Or China and the U.S., the more attractive those countries become to Russians, because the way of sort of thumbing themselves at the supposed victors in the Cold War.
What is the state, I don't know if you can answer this question, but what is the state of Orientology today in the Russian Federation? Are the faculties strong and do they get students? And, you know, is it a thriving sort of thing? Or is it like foreign languages in universities in the United States?
Yes, I know. Yes, we of course thought about that. Yes. Well, Russians are much less afraid of learning languages than Americans are. That's a good thing. But Orientology really has a mixed legacy in Russia. And it's really the best way to understand Orientology's mixed legacy in Russia is to go to its two centers, St. Petersburg and Moscow. In St. Petersburg, it's a very rarefied intellectual atmosphere there on an old faded Grand Ducal Palace just down from the Hermitage. And there you have people who read old manuscripts and are sort of take a very bookish intellectual approach to Orientology. But like all of Russian academics, these people do it out of a love for learning, not out of an expectation of earning a salary. If you go to Moscow, there, instead of saying wearing frayed shirts or severe skirts, everybody there wears Hugo Boss suits and has constantly have cell phones. They're very much more linked to the real world. And that is because ties between Orientology and Russian intelligence until really the collapse of the Soviet Union were very intimate. It is no coincidence that Yevgeny Matkovich Primakov, his career took him from the Oriental Institute and from being a director to being head of the, one of the successors of the KGB. And then for a brief while under Yeltsin, his and prime minister. But here's a man who basically whose career was sort of half in intelligence and half in Orientology. There are, of course, still links for the state, but I would say that Orientology is still doing fairly well in Russia, judging by the publications that are coming out and by interest that people have in it. Possibly not as strong as it was in the Soviet era, because then the reasons of state to support Orientology were much, much stronger.
Are the Orientologists in Moscow and Petersburg and other places, are they actually from Central Asian parts and Eastern parts, or are they ethnic Russians?
Most are ethnic Russians, but there are some from other parts. I mean, I have to say that certainly when you go into the Institute of Oriental Studies in Moscow or in St. Petersburg, most of the people there have Russian names. But you do see names on the lists of say, Tatar or of Near Eastern origin. But they are now dominated really by Russians. Mm-hmm. By ethnic Russians.
Yeah, let me ask another question. I'm not sure you can answer, but I'm interested in it, and I imagine a lot of people who listen to the show will be interested in it. Has Said's Orientalism been translated into Russian and various Turkic languages?
It's been translated into Russian very recently, I think about 4 years ago. It's regarded fairly critically.
That was my next question. How has it been received?
Well, very in a very hostile way. The Russians, of course, well, like any great power, Russians see themselves as having a special relationship with those people that it comes to rule over. By the same token, by Orientology is the same way. Now, what is interesting about Russian Orientology is that in the early 20s, when Lenin seemed to fantasize about a special relationship between the oppressed Russians and the oppressed colonial peoples of the East, the Orientologists, most of them trained, of course, in the imperial tradition, argued that Western Orientology marched hand in hand with imperialism. But Soviet Orientology, of course, was underlaid with Marxist sympathy for the oppressed colonial peoples of the West. So Russians have always, Russian Orientology, even in Soviet times, always tended to see itself as very distinct from Western Orientology and much more respectful of Asian people. I won't go into whether that's true or not, but I will make one observation. And this is hardly an original idea. Vera Tols also actually did some very interesting work and discovered really that there's a direct link between Edward Said's Orientalism and the Soviet view, because Said, of course, did not read Russian. But one of the texts that he, on which he very strongly based, to put it diplomatically, his thesis, was written by an Arab who had read Russian Soviet texts about Orientology. And I want to quote, if I may, just this is the way that the Great Soviet Encyclopedia of 1951 described Orientology. Quote, reflecting the colonialist, racist worldview of the European and American bourgeoisie. From the very beginning, bourgeois Orientology diametrically opposed the civilizations of the so-called West with those of the East, slanderously declaring that Asian peoples are racially inferior, somehow primordially backward, incapable of determining their own fates. Bourgeois Orientology entirely subordinates the study of the East to the colonial politics of the imperialist powers. Now, from some Foucault, such other, and some other fancy terms, and there you have Edward Said.
That was something else, David. That was something else. Let me tell you what. David, we've taken up a lot of your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Let me close the interview with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your next project after going down to the cafe and having some pastis or something and relaxing?
Which I have a lot to do, actually. You know, it's 5:03 and happy hour just started 3 minutes ago. So, but I still have it lasts till 7 o'clock, so I don't have to rush.
Okay. Yeah. So what do you do
today? But I'm here basically to begin two things. One is all the summers that I spent in Helsinki, Moscow, Petersburg, writing the Orientalism book. Meanwhile, Marie, my wife, was raising our one and then two kids. She's a specialist in antique jewelry, and she has always wanted to write a book about Imperial Russian jewelry. A lot of books about Fabergé on the market, probably about 200, but none about all the other jewelers. She doesn't read Russian, so that's where my job comes in, is to help her do the research. So that's one project. Probably a coffee table book called Beyond Fabergé, Imperial Russian Jewelry. The other big project I'm involved in right now, and this is the one for which I'm currently am enjoying the largesse of the very aptly named SHRC, the Social Science Humanities Research Council, which gives you 3-year research grants. And I'm writing a book called Russia's Great Game, Tsarist Conquest of Central Asia.
Wow.
Just basically an archival study of how Russians thought about and went about that Russian expansion in Central Asia, largely in the latter part of the 19th century, you know, the conquest of the so-called Stans. But that's a much more longer-term project, which will take me to archives both here in France and in England this year, but eventually also back to Moscow, St. Petersburg, God willing, Ashkent, which has a fantastic trove of the Governor General's archives in Turkestan. I should say there's also a third project that is also keeping me up at nights. I know you've had as one of your guests, John Steinberg. Well, John and I, as well as a number of other people, are collaborating on a major reevaluation of the First World War, a project basically called Russia's Great War and Revolution. And together with a fellow Canadian, David MacDonald, a Brit and a Russian, we are editing the volumes on the diplomatic history of, Russia during the First World War and up to the Civil War. So those are three things that are likely to keep me busy for the next, decade or so when I'm not at a cafe.
Yeah, I was going to say that might keep you busy for the next century or so. At least if you're me, it would take me a century to work through all those projects. But, you know, then again, I haven't done all of the things you've done. So anyway, we've been talking to David Schimmelpennig-Vanderhooy today about his terrific new book, Russian Orientalism, Asia in the Russian Mind, From Peter the Great to the Immigration. I've really enjoyed talking to Dave today. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with David Schimmelpennig-Vanderhooy about his new book, Russian Orientalism, Asia in the Russian Mind, From Peter the Great to the immigration. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.